Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Being a successful clothing manufacturer here in America is very difficult. Daniel Weinbach is president of the Cat's Pajama, whose creations are sewn here in America and in Peru. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Don.
Well, I have to tell you, at the show that I saw in New York, your product stood out. There were about 1,000 other clothing manufacturers, but the one that I honed in was yours. Tell us about your company, your products, and your website.
Sure. So the Cat's Pajamas is about a 20-year-old company. It was initially started when two women out of Stanford saw an opportunity to launch a novelty kind of whimsical pajamas. And, you know, they got out of the gates running and came out with a sushi pajama that was quickly on some hit TV shows. Buffy the Vampire Slayer is probably the most famous, and we still get requests 20 years later for the Buffy sushi pajamas. Anyway, the company was sold to us about 3 years ago, and what we did was took this core of a brand and tried to reinvest both into the branding of it, the quality of the pajamas, the styles that we offered, and pump some new life into this 20-year-old company. So we have two different parts of the business. We sell to boutique stores throughout the U.S., and we sell direct-to-consumer primarily through our website at thecatspjs.com.
Okay. Well, but you manufacture here in the United States, and you also do in Peru. Tell us the different price points that enable you to manufacture here in the States and in Peru. And then we'll turn it over to Dan.
Sure. So we're actually fortunate in terms of price points because a lot of our competitors in the sort of mid-tier pajama category are priced at a premium to our product. So we have a little bit of flexibility, but we try to keep our retail prices under $100. So it's kind of an affordable luxury. The domestic production and supplying from Peru, believe it or not, the pricing is, or the cost to make the pajamas is not all that different. I think the issue that we've had domestically is we can't find enough quality sewers in Los Angeles to keep up with demand. So part of the initiative that drove us to Peru was just looking for someone who could keep up with our growth.
Dan, you want to jump in?
We had the benefit when we went to Peru of expanding the offering as well. So we were able to start having knit pajamas, which is a jersey, kind of like a T-shirt type material. And we also found some very fine cottons, sort of better than what was available on the market currently. So we've been able to broaden the portfolio, improve the category, and still have, price points that enabled us to retail under $100. So it's been a great success so far, and we like being in Peru as well because it's close to Los Angeles, so we can actually get the goods pretty quickly as opposed to having to wait to import them from Asia and wait for, the ports and everything else.
Daniel, this is Dan Perkins. Thank you. I have to ask you what probably going to seem like an outrageous question, but when you said that the two ladies founded sushi pajamas, Were these edible pajamas?
They're not, no. Our pajamas are very wholesome as opposed to some of the lingerie category, which could get a bit racy. No, what we're looking for and what we offer our consumer is, you know, something where they can come home from work and put on a really comfortable pair of pajamas, be around the family, be around neighbors, and not feel, you know, shy or embarrassed and be covered and feel happy about what they're wearing and comfortable. And, you know, so that's more what we offer. We're not doing any edibles at the moment.
Do, what's the use for Duttons? With feet?
We don't offer feet either, no. We offer more classic styles, the notch collar with a button down and styled after a men's dress shirt. We offer some, you know, short sets and capri length, short sleeve, and nightshirts, nightgowns, and robes, but nothing. We're not doing the, you know, full body suits or onesies or feetsies or anything like that.
Is it just primarily women?
We offer men as well, and we actually just launched some children's pajamas this year. But the vast majority of what we sell is women.
Okay. How did you? The original company you acquire had a relationship in Peru, or did you establish that?
They had previously imported from Peru many years ago, but that was no longer kind of in existence when I acquired the company. So it was 100% domestic when I bought it. So we reinitiated a Peruvian relationship. They were using a third party in the past, so it's sort of an intermediary, and I think that got challenging over time. So we decided to go direct.
So you're fascinated, your strengths of your business growth are the fact that you can't find high-quality sewers.
Yeah, I was surprised by that as well, that the, you know, sewers who we work with have said that the younger generation don't want to sew anymore, and so, you know, they have trouble finding the quality that they're looking for, and fortunately for us, they're not willing to just bring anybody on. They're, you know, set to a very high standard. And so, you know, I appreciate them letting us know that they weren't comfortable with that pace of growth. And, you know, it forced us to go find other solutions. But it's was a much better outcome than some of the experiments that we've had where we've tried to, you know, find other suppliers locally that haven't worked out as well.
So your sewers in Peru are contractors. They're not, you don't own them.
That's correct.
So
actually one of the companies we work with in Peru is the, you know, largest. They're vertically integrated. They grow the cotton all the way through the sewing of it. So they're you know, a very large company who what happened to Peru is after the 2008 downturn, a lot of the retailers and manufacturers who were working with them from the US went to lower cost locations. And so I think Peru found itself with some excess capacity, which created an opportunity for smaller businesses to work there.
So are they a possible solution for your quality sewers? Are they outside the United States?
I'm sorry, are there other locations? Was that the question?
No. We're working in Peru right now. Do they have the ability to give you more capacity?
Oh yeah, we're very small relative to the size of these companies, so they can scale with us much more easily than the domestic production. So it's, you know, we've had to change our supply chain and sort of the way we go to market with product, but you know, we've been lucky. So part of the benefit of Peru is because it's so close, we actually air the product in. And then by the time it reaches our warehouse, it's basically been pre-sold. So it, you know, we take it out of the box, drop, you know, repack it into either to stores or directly to consumers, and it's basically gone when it gets here. And so it's worked out really well for us.
That's in this business model, that your inventory is sold. That's more than just in time. That's sold and let it go. So when the ladies had it before, when you bought it 3 years ago, did they have a strong internet presence, or is that something that you developed?
Actually, what attracted me to the business in the first place was they did have a nice balance of direct-to-consumer, so internet and retail stores. Obviously, the margins on the direct-to-consumer, even with the shipping and everything else, is a lot more attractive than the wholesale margins. So I liked that balance. But one of the things that's happened in, you know, since we own the business is we got lucky and found a great national sales manager who has come in and really dramatically expanded the boutique business side of the business, so the wholesale side. So we've, you know, we're now catching up on the web to keep up to that 50-50, but we've been really fortunate to find someone who had, you know, 20 years of experience in the industry and could really take the product that we had now improved and enhanced since we bought it and push it out to the market.
Did you want to ask something, Don?
Well, I wanted to say we're talking with Daniel Weinbach. He's president of Cats Pajamas. And I just want to break in on a question and ask, did you have another business that you added this one to, or did you, in effect, buy this business and then grow it?
No, we just bought this business and grew it. My background previously, I was a management consultant and then a hedge fund manager. So this the whole garment industry is all brand new to me.
Well, the fact that you're successful at it speaks volumes about your ability.
Oh, thank you.
Dan Perkins, back to you.
Thank you. I'm fascinated because we have had a number of guests over the last 4, 5, 6 months who have, I don't know whether struggle is the right word, but dealt with retail distribution in brick and mortar, and at the same time offering their products in an internet model. And I'm curious as to how you balance your relationship with a brick and mortar distribution with your online distribution. How do you make them want to buy your product, knowing that their customers anywhere in the world can go to your website and buy the product?
So it's an interesting dilemma, and believe it or not, it's part of the sort of thesis or premise that I had when I bought the business, was that a lot of brands will struggle with the transition and the tension that exists in the market today, which actually creates an opportunity, I think, for someone who can bring the sort of online skill set to the business and the ability to manage that sort of tension. So what we have done is we believe that we've created a very, very high quality product that at our price point is unparalleled in the market. So for our retail stores, we're offering them a value proposition they really can't find anywhere else. And we have a very unique look and feel to our product. There's nothing quite like what we do. We have these vibrant colors and crazy ideas, and we have some subtler things as well, but it's really, there's a lot of personality in our product. So for a retailer, you know, in the pajama category, which is a very high gift category, we do think that we're offering a great value proposition to them. For the direct-to-consumer, you know, the more, I believe in multi-channel buying. I think customers who see your product at retail are more apt to buy online, and those who buy online still will buy more in the stores. So, you know, I think what we're doing with our retailers is a win-win on both sides. I think, you know, at least from the reorders that we see and the growth that we're experiencing, the retailers are having a lot of success. Our online customers are having success. The feedback we get from customers is great. So knock on wood, but for the moment we seem to be managing the multi-channel and not owning both pieces of that okay for the moment.
Dan, we have to break in a moment to hear from one of our sponsors.
Life, it's made up of the simple day-to-day moments that keep us all running on full of joy, passion, and restlessness. It's singing full on to your car radio with the windows wide open. It's a whole bunch of early morning rush hours and a few late night runs for Rocky Road. It's full of pit stops and drive-thrus. It's life, and we live it between fill-ups at Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
We're back here with Daniel Weinbach. He's president of the Cat's Pajamas, which is a fairly unique pajama company with some very unique designs and a multi-level approach to how to market. Now back to you, Dan.
Thank you, Dan. I was going to ask before the break. Is the product line offered online a duplicate of what's available in the retail store, or do retail stores tend to have a smaller selection than what is available online?
The retail stores have a smaller selection, but only slightly. We'll have certain styles where we will run sort of internet only. They're available to the retail stores if they want them. It's just not necessarily something we think will have as broad of an appeal that would necessarily be as successful in our full retail boutique world. So we tend to offer them, you know, online where you can get a more of a niche-y audience. But no, it's generally the same product. It's interesting when you think about the tension. I think in our world, there's more tension between department stores and boutiques than there is between boutiques and online. The department stores have become so discount and sale oriented that if you have the same product in a boutique and a department store, that's really challenging for them. We're fortunate that we don't sell to department stores. We haven't found that to be profitable business, and so we've stayed away from that for the moment. So I think a lot of the sort of natural tension that exists in the retail world, you know, we're able to keep our boutiques away from that.
There's a great discussion going on today about the ability of the big box to survive. I saw a report that the expectation the National Retail Merchants Association. By the end of 2017, we could close 8,000. Oh, I'm terribly sorry. Couldn't get the news, but 8,500 stores in this year alone. We have seen Macy's and Sears and other companies announcing massive store companies. Era of the big box store in a shopping center rapidly diminishing and dying?
I don't know. I think that I believe retail. I don't think the whole world is going to go to an online buying environment. I think retail will continue to be an important part of consumers touching and trying and seeing new things and clothes and brands. Department stores, it's a tough one for me. I personally, as a buyer, have always been intimidated by them. I'm sort of overwhelmed and always found it easier to shop in boutiques myself. So I think they will go through a process of redefining and maybe the restoration hardware model where they're become more of showrooms and less about, you know, stocking goods will change the economics of their model enough that they can survive. But if that's the case, maybe the footprint's too big. I'm not sure. It will be an interesting next 10 years, I would say, as they try to figure out what's next for them.
Thank you for that. I want to move on.
Can I break in with a question? Because
sure.
I don't know if you're aware, but my mother spent 43 years in the garment business as a seamstress. When she was there, the ILGWU was the dominant player in the field, and individual dressmakers had a lot of problems. Is the union a problem in today's world, Dan?
You know, we're a small player and work with some smaller vendors downtown where I don't think the union is a factor that we've come in contact with. So I don't feel I'm in a position to give a lot of uh, a strong opinion on that. I'm sorry.
Back to you, Dan Perkins.
Not a problem. So let me go back to what I was going to ask you. Given the price points that you've talked about, is the product that you sell, would you call it a discretionary or gift item, or is it something different?
Well, no, it's definitely a discretionary gift item, although, you know, we have, you know, many of our customers own 10, 15 pairs of our pajamas, and what they say is, you know, they've bought them 10 and 15 years ago, and they're still, you know, they're still wearing them today. They, you know, we make a high-quality product. It lasts for a long, long time, maybe too long if we were really trying to maximize sales. But it's what we think makes, I mean, pajamas in general is a big gift category. You know, I remember seeing in the Wall Street Journal when Walmart talked about their holiday, it was, you know, flat screen TVs and pajamas that they were stocking up on. So, so I do think it is a natural gift category. I think what sort of uniquely positions us in that category is that our pajamas have so much personality that it says a lot both about the person giving it and the person receiving it. So, you know, I think that's been a big part of our success, that, you know, we're not just selling a, you know, a plaid or a striped pajama or a solid pajama. It's, there's a lot more to it. It's not all sushi. We're not, it's not all crazy like that, but there is a lot of personality.
The reason why I'm asking the question is it seems to me that looking at it from a man's standpoint, it's the price point is low enough that men would probably be buying something, and that they're being extravagant in spending something for their wife or their girlfriend. But what I'm curious about is how economically sensitive your market is.
I don't know. We haven't really crossed that $100 threshold, which is one that we're you know, delicately sort of pushing up against. I think, you know, when lunch costs $15, it seems like these days, at least around where our offices are. So, you know, to spend $100 on a pair of pajama that lasts you several to 10 years, it really doesn't feel like a big investment. And if you could see or hear the reactions we get from consumers about how much joy they get out of our pajamas, it's really remarkable. It's fun. I think it is a good gift category. I think that, you know, we get a lot of men who do, you know, make their wives happy. We get some who call up, you know, we know it's so-and-so's anniversary because every year on the same date, you know, that the husband's calling up saying, what do I get? We do experience that. We have pushed prices up a little bit in the last couple of years as we've, you know, had higher labor costs from the, you know, sewers domestically from higher minimum wage. So that has forced us to raise prices a little bit. We're still growing, sort of about the max that we want to grow. I think any more than that starts to get a little out of control. So we haven't felt the effects of sort of the elasticity of demand if we were to push up higher. And as I said before, we have some competitors in the marketplace whose prices are, you know, up to 50% higher and really don't even have the same quality that we offer. So we do have some more room to move up in price, we believe. But at this point, we're just sort of enjoying the growth and happy to be able to offer our customers those pajamas at that $100 price point.
How do you think the recovery, we just got a new number on GDP for the last quarter, it was, I think, 3.1 or 3.7, which we haven't seen anything like that in a long time, years. If the economy continues to recover, if you see a growth rate of, you know, 3 to 4.5%, there's going to be a lot of discretionary money spent. Would you expect that as people feel more comfortable about the economy and their income prospects, that could have a significant impact in terms of buying your company.
For sure. I mean, I obviously, you know, higher GDP growth will lead to higher discretionary disposable income and higher spending, and we will benefit from that for sure. The other sort of nice thing about the pajama category is even in a downturn, there's, you know, a sort of cocooning element to it where people are going to hunker down and stay at home. But if I'm going to stay at home, I at least want to be in a cozy, you know, cute pair of pajamas. So, you know, we tend to do okay even in the down economies as well.
So does the, you said you have men, and you, do you have children? You, I think you said you do.
We just launched our first children's styles this season, and, you know, we sold out of one of those two styles immediately, and so we're, you know, we're pleased with that, and we'll continue to expand it. You know, we're in the women's category, we're pretty confident that we have an idea of what our customers want, and as we move into new categories, we dabble slowly and want to make sure we're taking sort of smart risks, make sure that we're, you know, growing in a profitable way. And so we will have many more kids' pajamas next year after the reaction that we've seen so far this year. But at this point, it's a fairly limited selection.
Dan Perkins, I just got a – I'm listening to Dan Weinbach. He is an extremely smart businessman. I wish a lot of other companies would follow his advice. He is president of Cats Pajamas. Your website again, can you spell it out for our audience?
Sure. It's www.thecatspjs.com.
It's a fascinating place. My last question to you would be, if you had one piece of advice to give small business leaders, what would it be?
Oh, I think it's just to make sure you have fun with what you're doing, because you're in a small business, in a small company. That's a choice that you're making, not to go work for someone else. And so I think you have to make sure that you're doing something you love, because that's sort of the gift that you've given yourself by having to go through and suffer through all the challenges of running a small business. So you got to enjoy it along the way.
Dan Weinbach, thank you so much for being with you. At the show, I enjoyed looking at your product, and I'm glad you came on the program.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Daniel.
Take care.
At Valero, we believe life gets lived between every fill-up. So whether you go down the road on two wheels or four, whether your Wednesday night is spent racing to the grocery store or down a track, and whether you're dropping off the mail, the pizza, the kids, or all of the above, we're here to make sure you're never running on empty. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at valerocleangas.com.
Dan Perkins here with your recalculating.biz small business tip of the day. So you formed your business and you used an LLC. Do you really know what you want to do and how to get there? Not without a business plan. An old Chinese saying, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there. So here is your recalculating.biz small business tip of the day. There are a lot of great books on building business plans. I suggest you start simple. As your business grows, you can become more elaborate. I recommend The Business Plan for Dummies, available in local bookstores or at Amazon. If you know nothing about business plans, then a complicated plan may well scare you away from doing one at all. You used to be able to do things by the seat of your pants, but no more. Don't be a dummy. Get a book, and you'll be smarter for it. This has been your Recalculating.biz Small Business Tip of the Day. I'm Dan Perkins.
Small businesses increasingly need to reinvent themselves or come back from near bankruptcy. Bob Bethel is a turnaround specialist with a host of experience. He's here now to talk about his new book, Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies from the Man Who Has Rescued 77 Businesses. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Don. I really appreciate you and Dan having me on your show. It's it's very nice to be talking to you, two young guys.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Well, you evidently went on the site and saw what we look like. Handsome Dan and anyway. Bob, you have a lot to say, and we have such limited time. I don't know where to begin, but I'll start by saying, tell us a little bit about your background and what are the key points of your book about fail-proof strategies.
Okay, Don. Right out of college, I, of course, like most people getting out of college, knew everything. So I started a business. It did great for a couple of years. My father had spent his life in that type of business. So I started one. And as I say, it went great for a couple of years. Then we got hit with the recession, and I found out exactly how dumb I am. I fought it for a couple of years, ultimately went broke, lost everything, and took me a couple of years to get out from under it. Did not go bankrupt. And fortunately, a very wealthy friend of my parents had watched me go through this. He had retired but still had 20 different businesses. And he said, I don't think you'll do this again. I want you to come in and clean up my businesses. They're not doing well. And 52 years later, I'm still doing it.
I'm sure that Don and I can both relate to some shape or form. I remember when I left Wall Street and started my own consulting business. I said that I was only going to have five customers because I was concerned about the quality of work that I was going to be able to give to clients. And independent since 1989 and never got beyond three.
Wow.
And but I can really relate to reinventing yourself, because I don't know how many times in the time since 1989 when I went independent that I have reinvented myself, although my core business of managing money has still been there for all that time. I'm doing things today at 72 that I never envisioned that I would be doing. So I understand a small business and what's going on. I want to go back to you, though, and I want to ask you, in the 77 businesses you rescued, are there two or three things that are common with all of them?
You know, Dan, that is a great question. And being a year older than you, I feel able to answer this. After I started and after I had done 10 or 12, I thought, I'm doing an awful lot of the same thing. Well, it's got to be a fluke. So I kept doing it. What I have come to realize is all 77 were solved using the same strategies and procedures. I certainly didn't go in with the mindset of thinking that would be the case, but as both of you know, half of all businesses fail, and that's the reason I wrote the book. It's the reason I appreciate your show so much for addressing the small and medium-sized businesses. And here are some of the things that I found. And by the way, let me say this. Typically, I'm called in by a bank that is getting ready to lose their hind end. So to avoid that and to avoid pushing the owner or owners into bankruptcy, they allow me to go in and negotiate with the owner to take over the company. And in doing that, I get him off of his personal guarantee. So what I have found, and obviously outside of the 77 that I have taken over, I probably looked at 200 or 300 others that for whatever reason I simply chose not to take. But here's what I found. Not one of them has had a plan. And Don, I know you have an MBA. We both suffered through that. We've seen the Harvard MBAs. That's not what I'm talking about. When we go in, we set up a 90-day plan that basically says who's going to do what, to whom, when, and for how much. But none of these businesses have had a plan. None of these businesses are measuring their performance. And what I've come to find out is, yes, a large business that is doing extremely well can go off of their P&L. Small businesses can't afford to wait till the end of the month to hand over their books to an accountant or a bookkeeper, and then by the time the bank statements are reconciled, 40 days has passed. So we go in and we start measuring day one every single day against that plan. The biggest thing that I've found is none of these companies were using their team. And I mean their employees. And what I've always found, and I suffered it myself, when I was failing, every day I acted like everything was great. I didn't go to my employees and go, we've got a big problem. I need your help. So I've watched owners fight this battle by themselves. I bring the full team, every employee in on day one. We turn off the phones. We lock the doors. We all sit down. And top to bottom, I tell them where the company stands. Owners don't do that, I've found, because they're afraid if their employees know the condition of the company, they'll leave. Nobody wants to go look for a job. And the bad part of that, guys, is this. Every single time, the employees knew that things were wrong, but they always thought it was worse than it was. So I get the team. I don't make the plan. They make the plan. They're the ones down in the trenches. They know what their department needs and doesn't need. So those are the things, including fear by the owner. There's no discipline to perform, and there is no profit culture in that company. And that is up and down the line 77 times. I've seen it every single time. So addressing those things with a plan has worked 77 times. Never taken a company into bankruptcy. Never had one that did not become profitable. Five were over $300 million a year in revenue. It's across 25 different industries. And that's what I spell out in the book. When I got through writing the book, I've known T. Boone Pickens for over 40 years, and I sent the manuscript to him to take a look at. And he was kind enough, after looking at it, to write the foreword of the book. It's meat and potatoes. You won't find any concept. You won't find any theory. You won't find any Harvard Business School plans. It's down and dirty.
Well, I've been married to a Harvard MBA, and knowing how she feels much the same way that you do, I would like you to outline what you think a plan should include, the three or four key points that go into a plan, and then I'll turn it back to Dan.
What we do is start with a baseline of where that company is today. And we set goals in that plan that are realistic, both revenue and expense, which is obviously the biggest factor. And immediately we identify anything that we can cut without affecting the core business. And I don't do it. I don't make the cuts. People that work there simply have not been utilized. So our plan includes our goals. we take that 90-day plan, Don, we break it into monthly plans, and then break each month into weeks. And there's nothing in this book that costs you in order to implement the things in the book, but part of that plan is on day one, I bring in some whiteboards. I put them where everyone can see them. They're not hidden in my office or the accounting office. And we lay out what our revenue goal is, what our manufacturing per day goal is, and several several of those companies have had up to six boards. So those are the things that we measure, and we don't complicate it further than that in the beginning. As time passes, every 90 days, we draw up a new plan. But we check ourselves against that plan on a daily basis, and I have found it to be an unbelievable, invisible motivator. You don't have to send a memo out and tell them we're behind. All they have to do in the break room is walk past that production board. They know where we are. And I call that headlight accounting. Trying to work off of a P&L of last month, which is 40 days old when you get it, that's taillight accounting. And there are lots and lots of small and medium-sized businesses that can't wait 40 days to know where they are, because they can't orchestrate, and we talk about this in the plan. We have got to mesh our production and our accounts payable against what we're doing on a daily basis, because if one gets out of sync, it's going to throw us in the dirt. And you may have noticed I've said nothing about accounts receivable. I don't do accounts receivable anymore. When I was in my 20s, I got a line of credit from a bank, and my parents knew the chairman of the board, and I saw him a few days after that and knew that he didn't know anything about the line of credit, but I thanked him for it. And he said, "I need you to do a favor for me. I will stay out of your business if you'll stay out of mine." And I died laughing and told him I had no desire to be in the banking business. And he said, "You already are. You have accounts receivables on your books. That means you're borrowing money from me to loan to your customers to buy your product." And I sat down and thought about that, and I said, "Well, what can I do?" He said, "Factor your receivables. Use credit cards." So we put in our plan that we're not going to be in the banking business. And as I say, every single person is involved, and both of you would be shocked over the years that some of the lowest wage workers have come up with some of the very best ideas to add profitability to the company. And I view myself as a teacher. I teach accounting to them. I want them to understand. I show them the P&Ls every single month because, you know, it would be no different, guys, if you stop and think about it. And I know this is good old Southern country logic, but if Tom Brady Sunday runs into the huddle and says, "Snap the ball on three," what's everybody going to do? So I have found that utilizing the team every single time is the biggest factor involved in getting these companies back to profitability. I will take 5% of the credit, and I'm being liberal in saying that, and I mean that.
So how much time do I have, Don?
Plenty of time. This guy is terrific.
Okay, so let me downsize this a little bit, Bob.
Okay.
And Don probably knows this number better than I do, but I think something like 15 or 20% of the total small businesses in the United States are single employee entrepreneurs.
Yes,
like
sir. Right.
We have different challenges than somebody that's got a staff and multiple employees. What advice?
No question.
What advice can you give to people like Don and me, who are constantly looking? I mean, Don and I think would easily be over our careers classified as serial entrepreneurs, but there are others who are not. They run pizza shops or gas stations or garages or whatever, and that's all they do. But what about somebody who is living, for lack of a better description? What challenges do they have?
I think the biggest challenge, and let me say this, although I take over companies, I now have people that I have worked with that are part of our team. We go in, we set it up, and then I'm just like the two of you. I'm looking for the next deal. I'm on my own, constantly involved on a daily basis with all of the companies that we own. I visit them on a regular basis. 7 years ago, I brought my son in. He does an awful lot of the daily legwork. So I'm in exactly the same boat. And what I have found is this. When you are totally on your own, you lose all of your discipline because you don't have to have it. All three of us at points have put on our suit, put on our tie, gone to the office, had to be there at a certain time. That all goes out the window, and quite frankly, I like it. But the fact of the matter is, if you do not do exactly the same thing with yourself that I lay out and strengthen your business, and that is set those goals, measure them. You're sitting there on beautiful Sanibel. Everybody knows it's the greatest island for seashells anywhere on the Gulf. So you might choose this afternoon to go out picking up shells. Well, if you've laid out your goals and you have set them for this week, that's great, but Dan, plan on staying up late tonight because you're no different. You are a one-person company. So you've got to discipline yourself to precisely the same thing as if you were running a 100-employee plant.
Yeah, I have been there and run even larger than 100. And I gave that up many years ago because I wanted to be my own boss. But I have a real quick story for you. One of my partners and I were calling on Don in another enterprise that he's involved with, and we're talking on the phone last Sunday. And I'm coming up from Sanibel, and he's coming in from Cape Coral from Cape Cod. So I said to him, look, we can talk about the agenda, we can talk about everything, but here's the most important question. Are you wearing a tie? And he said, well, I think so. I think that's appropriate. But then he said, I don't know whether I wear a sport coat or a suit. I said, I gave away all of my suits, just as you talked about. And everywhere I go in a sports coat and dress slacks. And occasionally, very rarely, we'll wear a tie. But we both wore ties at Don's meeting. But there is a sense, you know, people say to me because of the various things that I'm working on, when do you sleep? I says, I don't know when I sleep. I go in bed. When I get in bed at night, I'm thinking about whether it's the novel I'm writing or the foundation I'm working with or new business enterprises. I never am ever able to shut my brain off. And I have to assume that a lot of serial entrepreneurs think the same way. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're exactly right. And I will say this about all three of us. If we quit, we'd probably fall over dead in 30 days.
I agree.
Fellas, I have to break in over here for a word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back with Bob Bethel.
Before you hear this, or this, or even this, before you turn a key, step on the gas, and let it rip, before you get up and out and on the road, you have to be fueled by something. Make sure that something is Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at valerocleangas.com.
We're back here with Bob Bethel. He's got a fascinating new book that I'll let him tell you the title and where you can get it, and with a foreword by T. Boone Pickens, which to me is a very important point. Bob, it's all yours. How can we get your book, and what's its title?
Don, it just went on sale last week on Amazon, and the title is Strengthen Your Business.
So let me ask you a question.
Okay.
We have had for a period of the better part of 10 years, with the collapse of the markets in 2008 and all the way through the Obama administration, we had a negative attitude in the economy. The White House kept a bootjack on the economy to keep it from really doing anything as far as growth. We've had the most tepid recovery since the Second World War. We've got 93 million people out of work still. We did a good secondary GDP number for the second quarter, but I talked to a lot of people on this show about expectations that happened in the last 8 years. What are the expectations? Don and I made a serious decision when we had another radio show. We that with the election of Mr. Trump, it's going to be a rebirth of small business. And that means a lot of people who don't know anything about small business are going to be interested in trying out. And that's why we created Recalculating for Small Business. What do you think the prospects are for small business going on for the next 4 to 8 years?
Dan, I think they're very good. I think the two of you are very correct, and I greatly appreciate your show and what you're doing with it. I think there is very definitely a pent-up demand of people going into small business. It makes sense for a lot of people. There are an awful lot, as both of you know, that are not prepared for it. And I have something I want to throw out that I know works, and I would suggest it for every single person either currently in business of a small or medium business or thinking about it, because all three of us know that there are an awful lot of new businesses that are created in a vacuum. And here's what I have done over the years every single time, regardless if I've been in that industry before, either online or before we had the internet, I would look in trade journals. I would find the top five people in my industry, and I'd call them. Now, very seldom did I get them. I got their secretary, and I said, I need some advice. I've just bought this business. Every single time I've had that call return, when that call was returned, I said, may I come see you for 15 or 20 minutes and get your advice? It'd be no different in me calling the two of you, and I guarantee you if someone did it, a young person that wanted to be a radio host and said, may I come and get some advice from you, you'd give it to him. And I have been given that opportunity for 52 years in all of these industries. And Don, as an example, I know you've been involved in the robotic industry. I bought a company, an engineering company, that had just invented and patented some tools for industrial robots. I picked up the phone and called Joe Engelberger at Unimation, which at that was the first industrial robot manufacturer in the States, and at one time the largest in the world. And I said, may I come and see you for 15 minutes? I spent 2 days in Connecticut with Joe. I learned more than I could have learned anywhere on earth, got great advice, took our P&Ls, took our plan, got his viewpoint of it. Now, I go through all of that to say this. The greatest tool small business owners could do for themselves is look and find the five most successful people in their industry. You're not going to get a competitor across the street to give you that advice. But find the top five. Call. They'll take your call. And go see them and sit down and say, here's my plan. Don and Dan and I came up with this plan. We're going to start in our garage. What do you think? Because we've been operating in a vacuum. You'll get the best advice. You may be told you're not ready to go into business. You may be told you don't have near enough money. But what you're going to get is harsh truth from professionals who've been there and done it and are successful.
Great advice. Great.
Dan, we only have 2 more minutes left. I think I could go a whole hour listening to him.
Well, you can call me again.
I may call you for advice.
Yeah. So do you think that the entrepreneurs of today are more prepared or less prepared than when you started?
Much more prepared. When the three of us were starting, guys, if you wanted to know something you didn't know, you'd have to go to the encyclopedia.
Yeah.
Today we're carrying in our pocket all of the information that's been created since the beginning of time.
Yep. I tell people when I started in the brokerage business, that's a way of telling them how old I am. I said, you built your book by making cold calls, and you had to make so many phone calls a day. And I said, do you have any idea how sore your finger can use when you're trying to use a rotary phone to make all those calls? And people look at me like, what's a rotary phone?
Oh.
Still in all, in my view, I'd much rather be living today than 50 years ago.
Absolutely. The past, as far as I'm concerned, can stay in the past.
Bob, last question. Dan, I'm going to jump in on you and ask this. What's the one single thing you would like to pass on to our audience?
Utilize your team. Share all of the information with them so that they can help achieve the company's goals. And buy my book.
Oh, that's important. The other, this is a quick follow-up to what you just said. And I've done a lot of business consulting over my lifetime. One of the biggest mistakes I found with corporations when they hire people with an expertise that they need and they realize that they need it, like you or me or Don, not being honest and disclosing everything that that person needs to do the best possible job. There seems
Amen, Dan. Truer words have never been said, and it goes top to bottom for owners. They got to start by being honest with themselves. But if you're honest with your team and give them the opportunity to help you, it'll work. It's, you know, I'm not the smartest bear in the woods, and I've known that all of my life, especially since I crashed and burned. So I decided next time around I wasn't going to carry all that weight on my shoulders. I'm going to spread it around, and boy, does it work.
Bob Bethel, it has been an absolutely fascinating time with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank both of you. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.